Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we... I don't want to make a big deal about this, but our show yesterday was our 2000th show. I probably should have said something beforehand, but just keeping track of it, I know it's around here somewhere, and I think I mentioned it a few days ago with Sean that we're heading into our 2000th show. And, you know, if you think about it, folks, 2,000 episodes anyway, I just wanted to share that with you, that we've been around that long, and we've been doing this, and you don't do this for, almost 10 years, 2,000 episodes, reading the same documents over and over, not get at least a profound understanding of what's in these documents, what they say, and so forth. So the more you read, the stronger a statesperson you can become in the cause of liberty and standing up and defending the Constitution, being a champion for the Constitution, period. You don't have to go to these, charging institutions to learn, their editorializing of American history and editorializing our Constitution. You will not learn it, and you will not learn what that Constitution is really telling you and what it means and so forth. Because you have to hear and you have to understand the back dialogue that only comes out of these two primary source documents. That being the notes on the convention, understanding, the arguments that it took to form the Constitution, and then going through the ratification debates of how they explained and justified each clause, each phrase in the Constitution, period. So with that, there's lots of people that go through all this different training. There's all sorts of training out there. Unfortunately, I don't know of any course out there that is focused. Now, I believe, and I've been hearing, that more and more people are focusing on the ratification base. That's great. I've been haranguing and harping on this since I started my radio, debut in 2013. I talked about it in my first book. That the true treasure of America is those ratification debates, in contrast to the Federalist Papers. Now, just to be clear, it has taken me this long. 2 years ago is when I finally, and I'm just, excuse the expression, but it was 2 years ago when I fell back asswards into discovering that the last 8 Federalist Papers were a sham. This was a huge scheme that Hamilton put into play and then gave them to the federal, the jurist in the Supreme Court, his protege, John Marshall. And they elevated the Federalist Papers as the gold standard in understanding the Constitution. And this is how the court system has completely transformed our Republican form of government into a judiciary form of government. And they did it with all assumed powers, none of them being legitimate. So this is the turning point, folks. When you look at the court and you look at what the court has done, there needs to be a complete revisement of the court to ensure that it goes back to its true function in providing justice under those limited and defined jurisdictions. I see this all the time. Where people in Washington State, they are going after the court cases of the election of sheriffs. They created this committee that is basically going to determine whether an elected sheriff needs to be replaced by an appointed sheriff. And this is bureaucracy. This is all unconstitutional. And so they're going into court to determine what to do. And their argument is this is not constitutional. So if you don't understand what I just said, they're surrendering their sovereignty to go to court, to allow the court to establish what the standard will be and not the people. This is not about election. This is about petitioning government for the redress of grievances. This is about getting the people in the representatives' grill. And this is why yesterday, Sean, welcome back, Sean and Tammy, confirmed, was it yesterday or the day before? It was the day before. We just reiterated this in yesterday's show so that Tammy would actually see this and go, oh, my gosh. They really helped clarify what that right of petition was, as I've been telling you. I mean, this is the first time you actually see it in the language of what I've been saying, right? I've been saying that our government is Republican informed. That means that we're not supposed to be petitioning the court. We're supposed to be petitioning our government, which is our representatives. And I've been saying that, but I never had a substantial, you know, well, there it is in black and white. Right there in the Maryland ratification debates. Because they said, you know, how many times do you read a book and the book starts off, we are going to be producing this book with ink on paper? I mean, it's like stating the obvious, right? Back in those days, they didn't think about stating the obvious of how they saw things, what their paradigms were. So when they talked about petitioning government for the redress of grievances, they knew, they understood, this is why we've gone over and we've bent over backwards, proving that the legislatures were the sovereigns. That does come right out of the ratification debates. They understood that. Those who have, and this is actually how they frame it, those who have the power to create the law, those who have the power to create taxes, they are the sovereigns. They are the ones that can oppress you, or they're the ones that can liberate you. The courts are not. And that even came out in the Maryland ratification debate as well. Both of those nuggets were all of a sudden this gift. It was a golden gift, an epiphany. And so it's this has been my path. I get these, you know, I get these strong feelings, and I'll make an assertion where I really may not have proof, but I could do a good job in proving I'm right. And then all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, like I said earlier, I fall back asswards into finding, you know, the irrefutable black and white. There it is that I was right. And it's not about me being right, folks. These feelings that come to me are far more divine than they are me and my brilliance. I don't know why, and I don't know how I was chosen or why I am the one that's finding these things. The question isn't really, why did it take 200 years? The real question is, what is it going to take this government back? It's not about me, it's about him. He and his glory will be, his will be fulfilled. And so we've been given these blessings. I'm humbled. I'm absolutely humbled to be one that's actually sharing these. I know that there's other people that have equally important jobs and work in all of these things that need to be done. So this is why we have to work together. But you can't refute what we're going to cover regarding the Federalist Papers, and we'll get into that at the probably by the end of the show today. We're going to finish up the Rhode Island ratification phase. Now, whether there's something provident that comes out of this, and you know, the interesting thing is it's always these obscure documents. It's kind of like the concept of the state legislature being the high court. That came out. I noticed that like over a year ago. I think it was the last year when Tammy and I kind of read the commissions of electing and appointing the delegates that went to the Constitutional Convention. The two states that identified themselves as the Supreme Court of the state. And it's not a body of jurists. The Supreme Court of the state was the state legislature, is the state legislature. They ultimately have the ability to decide and redress your grievances, which going back to what Maryland stated, yes, it is the legislature that has that. And And really, when we look at the holding of accountability, Maryland was only interested in holding the legislature and the executive accountable. They didn't care about the court because the court was they used the term denned. You know, they were kind of confined into this tight quarter that they could only do these things. They didn't have any legislative powers. Their job was to rule on these cases. Back in those days, opinions were opinions. Everybody had an opinion. And whether a judge had an opinion or not didn't matter. All of a sudden, they started printing the opinions. The opinions became the details of what was the law. Or I should say, when we really look at what Marshall did with the Federalist Papers and everything else, by expounding upon his opinions, later on, his opinions on these hallmark cases literally became the tools, or I should say, became the fulcrums in bending, lifting, and moving the law in the direction that the jurists wanted to do in aggrandizing their power. The only reason Madison and Jefferson never made a comment regarding the opinion is because the verdict of the case was sound. The justice was provided. So who cares if these guys rant? But when they basically brought in case law and precedents, this opened the door of using opinion in our legal system, where there's no allowance in the Constitution for opinion to come forward. Remember, they don't have the ability to interpret the law or redefine the law. And yet, with their opinion, that's exactly what they did. And that's exactly how they were able to just say, because it was an opinion that said, well, we can interpret the law. And they even cited the Federalist Papers in saying that. This is how they wove their evil web. And so, folks, it's not about who. It is about what are we going to do about it. We all need to be involved in demanding the restoration of our Republican form of government, our hybrid constitutional Republican form of government. So with that, and Sean's going to probably remind me, so just to keep that conversation at bay, please reach out to Jerry Winstrom. He needs all the support you can give him because he's running a statewide case. And this guy, when I'm saying running, that means he's actually in a car, vehicle, burning up gas and what have you. And, guess what? Gas, that's not a big deal anymore. I mean, it's almost free. I'm just being sarcastic. With the rising cost of gas, his campaign cost is going to be more and more inhibited. He needs as much help as he can get. And I'm going to tell you, you can't give him enough. He's already got a tough road to hoe because he's going against an incumbent who's basically already been anointed by the Republican Party. He needs a miracle. So I would ask all who pray, get on your knees and pray for Jerry. Get on your knees and pray for a miracle that we can get a champion in the center of the heartland of America to help becoming a mouthpiece in helping everybody start understanding how central and how focused we need to be on the Constitution. If it ain't in the Constitution, government should not be doing it, period. And with that, let's crack open let's crack open the Rhode Island amendments that we kind of just left off with. Yesterday we just literally ran out of time because, I don't know, somebody was running their yap, and of course that was me, but we ran out of time because of me. So with that, and I forget who was supposed to start this off, but I would probably just say, go ahead, Sean, and you can do the first one, and Tammy can do the next one, and so forth and so on. And
ladies first.
Ladies first, there it is, okay. There we go.
All right. We ready?
You bet. No problem.
Okay. The United States shall guarantee to each state its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this Constitution expressly delegated to the United States.
Okay, so they kind of, this is more of a declaration as I look at it. Somehow it's an amendment, but I don't know what that amendment would do. Anyway, let's dive into the second one. Go ahead, Sean.
I'm not sure if I'm on the right document. Y'all are on Rhode Island?
Yeah, Rhode Island. We're down on page 4.
Oh, okay. That's why.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you're in the right one. It's just...
Right,
Yeah.
That the Congress shall not alter, modify, or interfere in the times, places, or manner of holding elections for senators and representatives, or either of them, except when the legislature of any state shall neglect, refuse, or be disabled by invasion or rebellion to prescribe the same, or in case when the provision made by the states is so imperfect as that no consequent election is had, and then only until the legislature of such state shall make provision in the premises.
Okay, so this has been clarified in the ratification debates as to why the federal legislature was going to have this power of being able to inject the time, place, and manner. But that's it. The time, place, and manner doesn't dictate equipment, machines, or anything else. It just basically says where you will conduct the election via VOCA, which means, you know, by roll call, by voice, by paper ballot, or by electronic means, what have you. They could dictate that, but they can't give you those mechanisms. In other words, the federal government doesn't have the authority to go out and create a bid for a election system and then hand it out to the states. The state has the onus and the burden of conducting their own elections. So they can't centralize and say everybody has to use this one thing. Now, one would say that, well, that would fall under the manner, but don't forget, folks, the federal government did not have the ability to make any controls over how we were to govern and how we were to function within the states. They couldn't come in and dismantle the state-sponsored religions that were existing at the time of the Constitution. They were not to meddle in the state's affairs. But they did have the ability, and they kind of clarified what they were just saying here was a part of that clarification. That if there became a need that the federal legislature stepped in, and this is why in 1945, the federal legislature finally stepped in and said, look, there are way too many states that are not participating because too many states are voting early and there's a few states that are voting late and the people feel just disenfranchised because the outcome has already been secured. And to increase the voter participation, they said the elections will occur on one day, 24-hour, you have 24 hours to conduct your election. Or, you know, you can set the polls whenever you want to, but it has to occur on this one day. That's it. Day, time, they weren't specific on the time. The states were able to do the time, but they specified the day. They can specify the manner as well. The only reason they did this again was for the presidential elections, and basically the federal elections, to ensure that nobody was feeling disenfranchised. It kind of made a big hoopla out of this national obligation that all citizens should be participating in.
Wait, so then you're saying...
Go ahead, yeah.
You're saying at the federal level, they can specify the day.
Yep.
Just not the time.
No, they didn't.
Then how come states...
No. They didn't specify the time.
Oh,
they left that to the states.
Right, they didn't specify the time, just the day.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
But how come states delay voting and allow votes that come in days later to be counted?
Or early voting as well. Because technically...
Oh, yeah, early voting.
Because technically the federal government is not holding them accountable to the law. They created the law that says the election will occur on this day. There's never been a change to that law that allows early voting. They've just never gone after the states to say, we don't like that. You can't do that. The law states this. The law states that you will conduct your election on the first Tuesday of the month of November. And so...
Didn't you also say that, like, passing the Save America Act was also not something that the federal...
There are things within the Save America Act that would not fall. I mean, they already have everything necessary to dictate that they don't have to go back and say, you can't do mail-in ballots anymore. But they don't need the Save America Act to do that. They have the authority in the Constitution to say the manner will be in person via ballot at your precinct. Voting, because the whole United States is broken down in precincts. Now, the only question I would have is because all states in America have counties except for one. And we happen to have a subject matter expert on all things Louisiana. And so the question is, does Louisiana... Okay. Yeah, there you go. So does Louisiana use precincts like everybody else, voting precincts, where you go to cast your vote, or does Louisiana call it something different?
No, they call them precincts.
Voting precincts. So there you go. Yeah. So the federal government can mandate the manner in the conducting the federal elections moving forward will be in person at the precinct via ballot. That would be the manner. Now, it doesn't matter what color the ballots are. It doesn't matter, you know, the thickness of the ballot, blah, blah, blah. By the way, there is nothing in the Constitution that allows them to demand secrecy. Remember, the manner could be via VOCA, which, in other words, the sheriff, if they had it done that way, or the sheriff would deputize people to go to the precincts to conduct the election, where you would communicate who you wanted to vote for, because many elections were done via VOCA. How did they do that? What about the right of privacy? There was no right in privacy when it came to the elections. That is a participation of a public manner. And they want to make sure that everybody, it didn't matter whether how you were voting, but they wanted to make sure everybody was heard well and they accurately, oh, yeah, that's what he said. Okay. And because many people couldn't write. They couldn't write names and sign things and so forth. So they would make sure, okay, that is Mr. Robinson, and he's going to, you know, cast his vote via VOCA. And everybody, yeah, Mr. Robinson did cast that vote. So it's not just this, it's accountability. It's a traceability of ensuring that there was at least a record and a verified record that that person voted, and that's how they voted. Because if you change that vote to something else, then that right there is election fraud. And so having it known and verified confirms and ensures that election fraud cannot occur. Right?
Agreed.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So election fraud trumps your privacy. I should say, securing methods so that election fraud cannot be, you know, entering into our election system. In other words, the security of transparency and ensuring that how you voted is how you voted. Yes, I'm sorry, secrecy cannot trump that. Cannot trump that. And that's why the progressives always want to work in the dark. They want to work in secrecy because they know they can get away with all sorts of things. And they've been doing it. As a matter of fact, this goes back to the story of Landslide Lyndon Johnson. Why did they call him Landslide Lyndon? Because how the election went down in one little town. This was, I believe, his first time in becoming senator for Texas. The progressives needed him in, and the corruption in Texas was of such that I have to wait for just a little over a minute to give you the background on Landslide Lyndon. But you can look the story up. I'm not making this up. And this is proof of how election fraud, not voter fraud, how election fraud can be done because of secrecy. Anyway, we will be right back after this short promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so the story goes, and I'm just going to kind of paraphrase this. What ended up happening was, for some reason, and I don't know the details, but there was a reason why the town didn't actually compile the election, whether that paperwork got lost, damaged, what have you. But there was a whole town that did not have, and as a matter of fact, it was interesting because the election was so close that they needed just a handful of votes in advantage to Lyndon B. Johnson over the other candidate. And I forget how many votes it was in this town, so I don't know. I don't remember all the details, but the one detail...
87.
But the one detail that just stands out is it was the process of how they accounted for the voting was by the person. They basically took sequentially how the people showed up. And the people were so well organized in this town that they all showed up alphabetically. In other words, they aligned themselves as they worked through their names so that they all voted in sequence alphabetically. And that right there is something that just never happens, wouldn't happen, but yet on the record it did happen. And that one town secured Lyndon B. Johnson's Senate run. I knew it was a small town, and I knew it was a very tight race. And one would think that in such a tight race, there are laws throughout the United States that would not allow that race to actually be secured, because it would be under, you know, scrutiny, because the percentage of the votes would be so close, they'd say, we have to completely audit this. We need to verify. And that little town would have been, it would have been discovered, and all those votes would have been thrown out. But they didn't have that law in Texas. I don't know what states do have it, but I have seen that, where anything under a certain percentage of the votes, where they're within 1% or something like that, they have to do a full audit of the voting, or they do a runoff between another election between the two. So they have, I think Alabama and Georgia, some of the states in the South, actually just have a second election between the two, the top two people out of the general. So anyway.
Yeah, the election was actually a runoff that it happened in.
Oh, okay.
Oh, and it was infamous Box 13 from Jim Wells County that the votes were counted from.
Uh-huh. There you go. So there's the story behind Landslide Lyndon. So this voter fraud, I should say election fraud, has a lot of history in America. And this goes back to, you got to understand, the lust for power and control. And, you know, everything that's at stake within America, the higher up it goes to, you know, what's at stake, i.e., you know, when we look at, you know, the U.S. Senate or U.S. representatives and president, there is so much money today in those elections. They're going to do anything they can get away with, election fraud, voter fraud, what have you, because there's just too much at stake. especially in those races where somebody, a bad person, could actually, you know, get elected. So the question I have is, when you look at some of these voters, or I should say some of these candidates, or actually politicians, I'll give you two good ones because I think they're pretty decent people. And there's a few of them. Cruz is kind of a decent guy. And Rand Paul, decent guy. Tom Macy, decent guy. And there's probably a few others. You know, I actually thought Marjorie Greene or what have you, kind of decent. Not necessarily impressed with the things that they say and what have you. They have their moments. But the, nevertheless, you would think that they would not be able to get reelected. I'll give you a good case in point in one in West Virginia. Who was the Democrat that's, that I think he's still in, but I think he's not running again. Who's the Democrat that was literally, that's a Republican state. And he's held control over that Senate seat for a long, long time. It starts with an M. And I don't think he's in office anymore. I think you have to go back to, you know, a couple of years ago. But for the longest time, he would vote with the Republicans.
When Joe Manchin?
I think that's the case. Yes, I think that's the name. Where he would constantly, when it came down to deciding whether the Republicans were going to get their way on a critical matter or not, he voted Republican. Why? Because he knew that it was the Republicans to vote, you know, keep him in office. And that's why he never got removed. But I think that, you know, when we look at, you know, when we look at how we manage our politicians, we really fail in holding them fully accountable. Folks, it is far better to, you know, demand full compliance, and if they fail to give you full compliance, it's one thing to give them a first and final. But they have to understand there's no wiggle room. You start holding the bar, you start holding that line, and then next thing you know, everybody is going to start behaving appropriately. When they know that, you know, you're going to do anything, and they're, oh, shoot, we can't. I mean, I remember Tip O'Neill got replaced. And it was like this huge insult to Eastern Washington, or I should say how Eastern Washington was the brunt of everybody's joke because they actually voted out Tip O'Neill. He was the Speaker of the House for a very long time. And Tip O'Neill finally got replaced by a Republican. And I don't know if he actually got replaced because he decided not to run again or whatever. But everybody, oh, what happened? How is it you guys have a Republican? That was you know, the strong territory and no, that wasn't the case. It was all basically the fear of losing the control of what Tip O'Neill could bring home to Eastern Washington. When you get to that level of power, sometimes you become untouchable because, oh, he brings us way too much. He can do too much for us. And back in those days, that's when everybody wanted them to bring pork barrel projects and so forth. I think, I'm hoping we get to the point where we realize that is the epitome of how we get corrupted. We don't want government doing those things. The more they do for us, the less we can do for ourselves, and the more dependence we get, and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, let's go to the third one with Tammy, the Third Amendment.
Third, it is declared by the convention that the judicial power of the United States in cases in which a state may be a party does not extend to criminal prosecutions or to authorize any suit by any person against a state, but to remove all doubts or controversies respecting the same, that it be especially expressed as a part of the Constitution of the United States, that Congress shall not directly or indirectly, either by themselves or through the judiciary, interfere with any one of the states in the redemption of paper money already emitted and now in circulation, or in liquidating or discharging the public securities of any one state, that every state shall have the exclusive right of making such laws and regulations for the before-mentioned purpose as they shall think proper.
So, interesting, this one right here creates a conflict with different parts of the Constitution. They talk about the jurisdiction of the court. And then they start talking about the emitting of paper money. Now, if you go to the jurisdiction of the court and criminal suits and so forth, you know, that's true that they're not, they don't, the federal government does not have jurisdiction over crimes and those types of things. However, the federal court, or I should say the federal constitution in Article 1, Section 10, forbids states from emitting currency moving forward. Now, they may still have their current currencies, and those current currencies will be retired as the United States starts printing, or actually coining, silver and gold money. And that eventually was to replace all state currency, that they were not to emit any more paper bills or anything moving forward. Their printing presses must stop. So it's interesting because this kind of goes into their specific history of how they had probably, you know, not the biggest, but they had at least the most active printing press in printing whatever their currency was so that they could go around and literally watered down whatever they were paying out of state. And I have, it just, it boggles my mind how people would not reel that government in, because when they water down your currency, it is tantamount to stealing your property. But anyway, the fourth one, Sean.
That no amendments to the Constitution of the United States hereafter to be made pursuant to the fifth article shall take effect or become a part of the Constitution of the United States after the year 1793 without the consent of 11 of the states heretofore united under one confederation.
Okay, so what would the threshold of 11 out of 13 be? Let me see here. Now, actually, because they're wanting to tie it to a number, and if I'm looking correctly, let me see here. I need to pull up what states, because I think in 92, when they joined the Union, Vermont was already in the Union. And so when we examine, I think Tennessee had not come into the Union at this point in time, right? I'm asserting that when we look at, you know, the statehood, the order of statehood, I'm going to tell you that we've got Vermont that came in 91, Kentucky was just coming in 92, and that was June. And let me see here, because you got to kind of line these dates up. This is in May. So at this point in time, as they ratified, Kentucky's not in. So there were 14 states in the Union with them joining in May. That being said, to amend the Constitution with 11 states, would that be a three-fourths rule or not? And I think that that would be greater than a three-fourths rule with 11 out of 14. It was definitely greater, 11 out of 13, because I think it was nine states were considered the three-eighths, or I should say the three-fifths rule. But nevertheless, they wanted to get it fixed. Why would they want to do that? Why would they go down the path of fixing an amendment to, say, 11 states, right? I mean, am I missing something? Shouldn't there be something to allude to how it would grow? Because the Constitution was so favorable because it had a three-fourths rule standard. You had to have, and today it's 38 states. So anyway, obviously, this is, so far, out of all their amendments, everyone fell flat. So let's try the next one. Tammy.
That the judicial powers of the United States shall extend to no possible case where the cause of action shall have originated before the ratification of this Constitution, except in disputes between states about their territory, disputes between persons claiming lands under grants of different states, and debts due to the United States.
Okay. This one fell flat as well. Hey, Sean, why don't you go ahead and read the fourth one? Because we just missed that one. Go ahead.
The fourth one?
Yeah.
That no amendments to the Constitution of the United States.
Oh, no, that's what we, I'm sorry. My bad. That's the one we just read. So the fifth, the sixth one. My bad.
Yeah. that no person shall be compelled to do military duty otherwise than by voluntary enlistment, except in cases of general invasion, anything in the second paragraph of the sixth article of the Constitution, or any law made under the Constitution to the contrary, notwithstanding.
Okay, so I think the right of conscience and conscientious objection was a general principle that was maintained, but to qualify it only for general invasion, that's an interesting stipulation, because that means that today, had they got their way, you wouldn't be able to use a conscientious objection argument for not taking the COVID vaccine. And I believe that the conscientious objection is sacred. I believe that no person should be ever compelled to have to do anything because government wanted to make it a law to put something in your body, to do something to your body. I mean, there's got to be a line, of the powers of government. And the whole point of us forming and framing a government is to protect personal life and property. And for you to do what you want to do with your life is protected by the right of conscience. Yeah, I don't care what the Supreme Court says. If your conscience comes from a mathematical formula or whether it comes from the Bible, I don't care. If you're looking at whatever, you have an argument of logic or even, of mythology, I really don't care. Spiritual or temporal, I don't care. A person should have the right to basically not do something that government wants them to do to their body, go to war, what have you. Now, I do believe that there are ways of dealing with, like going to war. If you have a conscientious objection about killing somebody, then okay, then you can easily be trained as a corpsman or a medic or a cook, where you won't ever have the need to pick up a weapon and, kill somebody, do that thing that's reprehensible. But to put somebody into and force them into a situation where they just find it untenable based on, for whatever purpose, again, mathematical, doesn't matter, then we have to respect that. We need to respect that. But again, that doesn't mean that they can get out of service altogether. That means that they just won't be the one doing the thing that they find reprehensible. Now, I've never found anybody.
Like Hacksaw Ridge?
Yes. I've never found anybody that says saving lives is reprehensible. But yeah, that doesn't mean that there can't be somebody out there. I won't be a medic. You can't make, I'll kill people, but I'm not going to save their lives. But anyway. All right. So next.
Well, they could get some diesel and one of those long poles to pull, You know what I'm talking about.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so next one, 7.
That no capitation or poll tax shall ever be laid by Congress.
Okay, and actually currently capitation is being deployed by Congress in the Constitution, because that was a capitation tax placed on the slaves of $10, I think it's $10 a head. So this one fell flat. 8, go ahead.
That's a lot. Back then, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it was. 8.
8th.
Yep.
In cases of direct taxes, Congress shall first make requisitions on the several states to assess, levy, and pay their respective proportion of such requisitions in such way and manner as the legislatures of the several states shall judge best. And in case any state shall neglect or refuse to pay its proportion pursuant to such requisition, then Congress may assess and levy such state's proportion together with interest at the rate of 6% per annum from the time prescribed in such requisition.
And so, again, a state trying to keep out of having to pay taxes. You know, anything but having this blank direct tax. You know, the direct tax is the duty tax. It's the tax that the federal government placed upon states based on enumeration, based on census. Now, when we look at the income tax in the 16th Amendment, that changed everything. But it didn't change the Constitution in a way that they could implement it without uniformity. It only changed the application of the direct tax. Eventually, they basically got their way of creating a direct taxation from the employer. Now, the language of the 16th Amendment didn't allow them to actually go and start taxing income based on the pay of the employer. How did that happen? Because when we really look at the 16th Amendment, it didn't allow them to do that. It only gave them the ability to tax income. That means that if you made income, if they found out you made income, you had to tax on it. And they could make people reporting who got paid income, but they couldn't go to the employer to take your money. See, income is property. You go into a contract, a labor contract, and you perform a certain amount of duty, you know, you perform these works, whatever, and they agree to give you a certain amount of money. The fact that the federal government got in between that contract to say, you're not giving them that amount of money, you're going to take the taxes out and give it to us. They didn't have that power to get to jump in the middle of that. What should have happened was it should have been the onus. But the reason that they did this and the reason most everybody just kind of turned their head is because, and the, why the businesses wanted to do this. The businesses just started doing it. A lot of people got upset about it. But the reason that they did that was so that they wouldn't be making martyrs left and right out of people. Because there would be lots of people standing up and saying, I'm not paying this tax because this is a non-uniform tax. I am paying more, or you know, I would doubt that anybody would stand up and say, I'm not paying too much. I'm not paying enough. You know, every once in a while you get that liberal billionaire that says, I need to pay more. But, I mean, most people would never say that. And when it came down to it, they wanted to alleviate, you know, that individual, you know, I'll just say resistance. They wanted to reduce and eliminate the resistance of the people. And so the direct taxation on employers', you know, wages to their employees was a huge sham. Huge sham. But anyway. Let's do the next one.
That Congress shall lay no direct taxes without the consent of the legislatures of 3/4 of the states in the Union.
And see, that's again just another whack at, you know, the power that they needed. In other words, they wanted to make sure that they were trying to take away the power that was necessary. The whole point of the convention was to give the federal government the ability to assess and levy taxes and receive those taxes. And instead, you know, we don't want to pay taxes. You know, give us 3/4 of the states to be able to stop you. No. That right there undermines the necessity of government being able to pay its debt. Anyway, the 10th one.
Number 10, that the journals of the proceedings of the Senate and House of Representatives shall be published as soon as conveniently may be, at least once in every year, except such parts thereof relating to treaties, alliances, or military operations, as in their judgment require secrecy.
Okay. 11.
11. That regular statements of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published at least once a year.
Okay. And, I mean,
that would be nice.
To me, so they do that, though. They actually do that. Now, even with that, it doesn't mean that they, you know, if you look at the laws and the whole point of this transparency, They've taken a simple statement like that and have, you know, created, you know, these different, I'll call them firewalls, so that they keep you from really seeing, you know, the full money trails or what have you. So obviously this didn't become an amendment. The next one, standing armies.
As number 12, as standing armies in time of peace are dangerous to liberty and ought not to be kept up in step, except in cases of necessity, and as at all times the military should be under strict subordination to the civil power, that therefore no standing army or regular troops shall be raised or kept up in time of peace.
Next.
That no monies be borrowed on the credit of the United States without the assent of two-thirds of the senators and representatives present in each house.
So the only problem I have, because I get into these arguments all the time, it's not about taxation, it's about spending. And when we look at borrowing money, there are points in time where we need to spend and borrow money to spend constitutionally, to defend ourselves, to be able to deal with some exigencies, international exigencies, whatever you want to call them. Therefore, as we kind of look at this whack at the Constitution, yeah, I think that, you know, they really missed an opportunity in basically saying we want to be able to ensure that the expenditures, because they kind of stated that before, right? I mean, I think that they talked about, you know, the public monies and expenditures in 11. And so I think that they really missed the fact that there needed to be a check on ensuring that the expenditures were directly a derivative, or the expenditure was derived from a very specific enumeration within the Constitution. And, you know, basically what maybe the language, because we know that the one thing that they were missing was the accountability. That Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was absolutely necessary to be able to quickly remove somebody for doing some shenanigans that were violating the Constitution. And spending money is a huge shenanigan. So especially on things that they don't have the authority to do. So I would have loved to have seen something like that at that point in time, because I think it would have shifted the paradigm that we're all suffering under. This evil mantra, you know, taxation is theft. Well, not if you're going to live in a civil society where you have to have a government. Government requires cost. You know, you can't compel people to serve in government, nor can you compel them to serve, you know, in the front lines. There's these conscientious objections and so forth. But the point is that government costs money. And taxation is the necessary evil. It is the spending that becomes, you know, the problem of causing more and more taxation. Are they spending on things that they shouldn't be spending? We shouldn't be paying it. That's why every show I start off with, our debt is fraud, and we don't know that. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.